Yeah, I think CRO and product they have a lot of similarities, but then they're also quite different in other ways. I think there's a lot of overlapping skills, a lot of overlapping work. In many cases, you'll find that there's somebody that's doing CRO or there's somebody that's doing product management. In smaller companies, you often don't have somebody doing both.
Hi, my name is Romel Santiago, and I'm the founder of Experiment Nation. Today, we have Bryce York, the Director of Product Management at Tatari. Experiment Nation's Richard Joe recently spoke to Bryce about overlapping skills in CRO and product management, quantitative and qualitative data, and the natural loop of CRO work, choosing between being smart and getting lucky, and finally, the importance of documentation. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Let's get to it.
Hey, it's Richard from the Experiment Nation podcast. Today, I've got Bryce York on the phone. Bryce York from New York. I just made that up now. But look, it's Bryce originally from, was it Melbourne or Sydney?
Sydney.
Awesome. You're currently head of product development, I believe, at Tatari, which is a advertising analytics platform. Is that correct?
It is for TV. Yeah, happy to. I'll share a little bit more about that when we kind of get into stuff. But yeah, that's where I'm at now. So yeah, originally hailing from Sydney, Australia, but now based in New York City. Been here for coming up on 5 years now. So it's nice to hear a familiar accent and chat to somebody that's from the other side of the world where I'm from.
Yeah, typically I'm Kiwi posing as Aussie, but I think that my accent softens a little bit. Cool. So look, you got a very interesting history and background, and it is a very entrepreneurial background. I think having you on the show would be good to discuss maybe some of your background, like what did you study, how did you get into product management and experimentation and to growth and those sort of things. Can you kind of go through your background a bit?
Yeah, sure. Happy to tell a story a little bit. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me. And it's been kind of good teeing this up. So working through those time zones, being on opposite sides of the world, I'm glad we were able to make it happen. So education wise, I went to uni studying a business degree, majored in marketing, was sort of my focus there. I would say I didn't learn that much about marketing. I kind of learned more about general business kind of concepts and those sorts of things. From there, I kind of got out into the business world through university, kind of meeting into through the Entrepreneurship Society. We're talking about this actually before we went on the record and turned on the recording. I met a guy who was running kind of a entrepreneurship education company. I kind of always had this entrepreneurial streak. I got kind of pushed and asked to read Rich Dad Poor Dad when I was about 15. And then after getting nagged about it by my old man for 2 years, I eventually did read it and then was like, hey, this is actually really interesting. You know, I don't have to have a job for my whole life. So I kind of was hooked on this entrepreneurship thing. Like, actually, it's not just owning a job. You can actually own a business and get leverage through that. And so I kind of had this fascination and everything there. And timing wise, it was very like kind of on the money. So I met this guy who was kind of trying to build a school for entrepreneurship. Where can you learn this? Because universities weren't really doing it. So that kind of kickstarted my career. Ended up at that company, kind of growing through the ranks. Started out through just volunteering at events and actually ended up being CEO of the company. And it was a very conversion focused business. It was all about like kind of driving leads through free materials and videos. Then building that into an email newsletter and kind of progressing through a ladder of offers that ended up kind of growing into like a monthly mastermind in person in kind of two of the main cities in Australia. So it was a really great experience and I kind of learned a lot about what I knew and what I didn't know and kind of being around that and making it work was such an awesome learning experience. And that was where I really kind of got interested in growth and experimentation. I didn't really know what product management was yet. That kind of gets figured out a little bit later in the story. So I was kind of into that and started studying some of the old internet marketing stuff. Being on Warrior Forum and buying Frank Kern's materials, all that sort of stuff. So kind of went down that rabbit hole of really copywriting and that sort of thing and being fascinated by it. And you can test things out, run an A/B test and you know, make more money and be able to actually measure that. And I found that sort of fascinating. So was there for a while. Then after I kind of had seen that through, I went out and started my own little mini agency doing kind of exactly that stuff, focused on e-commerce businesses. So got in really early into the Shopify space. So this is around 2010, 2009. And sort of got into it around then. And
that's early really stage agencies, because no one was doing that at the time. Yeah. Not many people was really specialized in Shopify. Like it just
they weren't the winner yet. It was still a lot of people were on WooCommerce and working through all those sorts of pieces. So there's a little bit of that in it, but I really liked what Shopify was bringing into the table and making just a better solution for everybody. So I kind of leaned into that and was really focused on building out stores that were really conversion focused. So it was kind of web dev agency focused on conversion. So that was really where I got deep into it and obsessed with it. So building out and running tests and experiments and A/B testing and all that sort of stuff for clients as a service. And so sort of did that for a couple of years. And that was really a foray into that space. And then kind of also learned how to code just to be able to kind of solve stuff myself, working with offshore engineers, all those sorts of things. And then I joined a company as employee number one, a company called RadFrame. Our focus there was around teaching enterprise companies how to operate like startups, how to take a more experiment-driven approach, not assuming you know the answer to everything, design thinking, lean startup, all that sort of stuff. So we built out this education, learn by doing platform that was really focused around that. That's kind of where I got my first foray into machine learning and AI. Sort of taking what does an expert do and then turning that into a system that could do it for you, adding leverage there. And then actually speaking of the Warrior Forum, around that same time when I was finishing up there, it got acquired by freelancer.com. And I actually interviewed for the CEO role and ended up deciding it wasn't quite the right fit. But that was almost a path that I took of heading up that company, which was cool to go from just some guy reading it that didn't know anything about anything to you know, having that potential there. So it's funny how things go full circle. And it was actually at that company, RadFrame, where I discovered what a product manager was, because we had an intern that we were working with. And we're like, you are awesome. You are such a smart guy. You know your stuff. We'd love to hire you as soon as you finish school. What job do we have to create for you to be here? He's like, oh, I want to be a product manager. Do you think that you could make that work? And I'm like, oh, let me Google product manager. And I was like, this is what I've been doing for like 3 years. Cool. Guess I'm the head of product then, as opposed to just the guy. So
you were kind of just intuitively doing it. You feel like, like looking back, like you were just intuitively doing these things that a product manager does, or but you didn't have that title yet, and it wasn't like a thing that was formalized in your brain, like, oh, I'll study product management. But looking back, do you feel like you've had to go through, I don't know, any courses or read through some books to like refine your knowledge about product management? Because, you know, you can go for the intuitive pathway and just sort of do it without the title, so to speak. But do you feel like you've had to have any maybe mentorship or books or whatever?
I think those things all go a long way. At the time, product management wasn't something you even could study formally. They weren't like product management schools, and you certainly couldn't major in it at university. Today, that is an option, which is really cool. A lot of that is similar to, like I mentioned, the marketing degree. Like, it didn't make me a better marketer, but it enabled me to learn how to be a marketer later. And so I think a lot of those product courses are in that same vein, where they teach you the ways of thinking and the ways of approaching, but it's not necessarily as pragmatic as actual practice. I think actually one of the best ways to learn how to be a product manager is try and build a product for yourself, like a little side project. Doesn't matter if it actually makes money. Ideally, you try and do that, because that's just like an extra barrier. But with all these no-code tools that are out there today, you can really actually build something. And if you're a CRO, you're in a pretty great position to actually go out and market it, which is the part that most people with a side project, most people that are building a product are terrible at, because they're just like, if I build something awesome, then people will show up. But for me, books were such a big part of it. There's so many great books in the product space, and entrepreneurship as well. You want to sit around that. One of the best ones for building a product from scratch, running lean. It's kind of like everybody knows the lean startup, but I think of that as kind of the textbook which is not for everybody and is very heavy and rich with information. I think of Running Lean as the recipe book of like, follow the bouncing ball, do this, do this, do this. And Steve Blank's, I've actually got a copy just over here somewhere, slightly out of arm's reach. But Steve Blank's Startup Owner's Manual is also an incredible resource. So great place to start.
Yeah, Steve Blank. I think I remember reading his similar book maybe 10 years ago. It's very applicable. And a lot of the sort of, like you said, a lot of the same things we're doing in CRO world where it comes to looking at qualitative and quantitative data and prioritizing and all that sort of stuff. Now you're at what brought you to New York?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry.
I lost myself on my on my backstory a little bit there. But yeah, from there I ended up at a company called Finder. A site that helps people make better decisions, comparison website.
Yep.
And they're a very CRO SEO driven company. So I went in there and focused on growth product management, worked in their global team, and then ended up transferring with them to New York. I wanted to move to New York for years just for the life experience of being an expat and exploring that. And that ended up working out really nicely with that role. And then once that time kind of came to an end, that was how I ended up at current company I'm at, Tatari, which is a ad tech company focused on buying and measuring TV advertising and turning that into a performance marketing channel, which is something that's really been made possible by this company, which is really cool. So you can actually get a ROAS for your TV ads, and it doesn't cost $1 million to get started. It's more like $5,000, which is pretty incredible. So unlocks a whole new channel once you start to hit the ceiling on e-commerce, and the volume that you can get and the scale you can get out of that certainly unlocks some pretty cool experimentation opportunities for the CRO folks for sure.
Yeah, we'll get into that shortly. And thanks for keeping it to experimentation framework. Of course, like let's put it this way: like your product manager, a lot of our folks, there are some product managers in our audience as well.
I bet.
Who do like experimentation and growth. Maybe you can talk about certain things like pure CRO and product management experimentation. Maybe talk about the differences between the two, and maybe talk about like when product managers try to get into an experimentation sort of process, what common mistakes they make and what kind of mindset they need to have, because there are differences, like it's sort of same but different. Maybe talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is Romo Santiago from Experiment Nation. Every week we share interviews with and conference sessions by our favorite conversion rate optimizers from around the world. So if you like this video, smash that like button and consider subscribing. It helps us a bunch. Now back to the episode.
I've almost entirely been at companies under 350 people, ranging from 3 to 350 over the decade plus of kind of doing this stuff. And in many cases, you'll find that there's somebody that's doing CRO or there's somebody that's doing product management. In smaller companies, you often don't have somebody doing both. And so you kind of end up backfilling for one another if you don't have that. So I think that's one of the really interesting things that you've got to look at is if you want to get into one or the other, like if you're a product manager wanting to get into CRO, you're a CRO wanting to get into product, finding a small company where they're not separate roles is a really great way to sort of transition between the two. So a lot of the stuff that's similar is looking at prioritization. You've got myriad ideas. You've got to come up with those ideas, think them through, and then sort of figure out upfront which ones are most likely to have an impact, making sure you're making big swings, but that they're also realistic. Like you don't want to set out on some quest that has very, very low chance of panning out because the opportunity cost is so high. Places where it's different though, I think, is really in the altitude that you're operating at and the resources that you have at hand. When you're a product manager, you've generally got a designer that you're working with and a number of engineers, and more today, and as we go forward, working with data scientists and machine learning engineers as well. And so you've got a lot of firepower that you can direct and aim which is both a really cool opportunity, but also a lot of pressure because it's not just your time. Like if you spend your time working on something and it doesn't work out, when you've got a team of 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 people, even as an individual contributor, you really got to make those things count and be agile and ready to go. And so I think that's also something that's a difference between how experimentation fits in. I think as a CRO, most of the time you're looking for experiments that themselves deliver the outcome you're looking for. Yep. You want to run a test and see an upshift in conversion, and that's exactly what you're looking for. That's the outcome itself. Most of the time in product management, you're not actually getting to do that. It's a step along the way. Most of the time, the experiment is about validating some assumption that you have along that way. Whether it's, do people actually want this? Is this actually viable? Are we going to be able to get more value out than we give? Are we going to be able to give enough value to the user? And is it even feasible? Is this actually thing actually going to work? So you kind of got that piece as well, where your actual deliverable isn't the experiment itself. The experiment's just about reducing risk and kind of helping guide you along the path. I don't remember the exact number of the stat, but any space shuttle that's on its way somewhere is actually off course the vast majority of the time. But because it's self-correcting every few seconds, it's like, oh, a little bit to the east, a little bit to the west, and correcting along the way, you end up at the right place in the vastness of space. I think that's one of the key things of experimentation in product management, is where you're doing exactly that. You've got this like general direction that you're trying to get to, and you're using experiments and testing along the way in order to kind of go, oh, actually not that way. That didn't quite work.
Would you still have like a, you know, they talk about North Star metrics and see at the CRO world, like, you know, we've got a North Star metric of, I don't know, say it's e-com and, you know, I'll just make it up, like, you know, increasing average order value by X percent or whatever. Do you still follow like a sort of framework of having this North Star metric in product or growth?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Yeah, how does that work out?
Yeah, in product and growth, it's very much the same thing. Often the same metric as well. And so we're kind of working in that same direction, just kind of bringing different tools. And in an ideal world, you have a bit of both. And depending on where it is in the funnel is kind of the tools that you have available there. So yeah, definitely a commonality there, working towards that metric. And especially depending on the type of company you're in as well. That's one of the big variant factors in product management, is that it can really vary a lot between the company stage or the type of business that you're at. So when you're at a smaller company, there's just going to be less data to work with. And then if you're in a B2B company versus B2C, especially if it's enterprise, not like B2B individual users, SaaS, where it's like you get everybody in the company to use it. Like Slack isn't exactly lacking for data. But if you've got a product that you're selling in that's only used by 3 people in the company, then your volume of data is going to be very different. And that changes the nature of the types of experiments you need to run. You've really got to take bigger swings in order to even be able to measure what's coming out. So you got to design your experiments to be proportional to the expected impact. So the amount of data you're going to get, more data means you don't have to have as much impact, but less data means you really got to blow things out of the park. So a lot easier to get to a significant result if you're 10xing the metric. But 10xing the metric isn't always easy.
Yeah. I mean, you always hear like read those like articles about, you know, like crazy experiments that, you know, 10x or 100x or whatever. And I'm always sort of a bit cautious about those sort of experiments because they don't talk about all their failures and all those sort of things, you know.
Yep.
Maybe go through the process of how you go about looking at qualitative and quantitative data and developing a sort of hypothesis and testing framework in your role. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. So my current role is a company that is at the coalface of that data versus impact kind of challenge. Is we're a company where our client, if they're really happy, they might only still have 2 people in their business actually using the product. And so with that makes scale harder in terms of like user experience type experiments. But then when you look at the media spend that we're working with, so people putting actual media dollars through the system, we have hundreds of millions of dollars in that case over the lifetime of the company, billions of dollars. And we have all that historical data. So you have a different type of experiment that you can run that's more about the impact of actual behaviors and strategies and methods for buying and measuring advertising. So there's always a different place to look to find where the data is, and you can focus your optimization in that area, I find. The other dimension that comes into it is quantitative and qualitative. You sort of touched on this a little bit earlier. I like to think of those as like a loop that feeds into one another. So looking at your qualitative aspect is really feeding you ideas and turning those into hypotheses. So whether that's customer interviews, talking to internal proxy users, a proxy user being they're not your actual end user, but they know your end user really well, really good for adding extra data. So if you don't have the bandwidth, or when you're early stage, you don't have the number of clients to go and talk to 12 people, you can talk to 3 or 4 people and then talk to people that know that customer really well. So your customer success teams, those sorts of things. So you can work with those in order to generate those ideas, take that divergent thinking. Oh, we think this. So we believe that such and such will result in such and such, therefore such and such. So really kind of building out that hypothesis and then turning that into the quantitative experiment and kind of putting that in. So process-wise, it's really focused on generating those ideas, prioritizing between those ideas. Then you get down to the actual hypothesis definition, experiment design. And there's lots of really interesting experiments that you can run in a more product-related context. One of my favorites that doesn't get used as much as I think it could is the red door test, or otherwise called fake features.
Painted door, right?
See if anyone comes a knocking. It's a really good way to learn without actually having to build it out, which I think is a common trap that a product manager can fall into, that I think CROs are much better at avoiding, is you don't have to build it to find out if it's going to work. So sometimes you can learn things before you go and do all that work of building out a feature to figure out if people actually want it, people are actually interested in it. And it's best practice to do that. When you've got a whole bunch of engineers at your hands, it's very tempting to go and build a bunch of stuff before you know that it's needed. So that's a big factor for a good product manager versus a great product manager.
Would you say that, in this case, like for the product managers that are listening, that, you know, they've got an idea to build these features and whatnot, and they've got an army of engineers, like you'd recommend painted door tests as a sort of form of risk mitigation, right? Like you're if you're putting this feature or fake button somewhere, you're sort of using that to gauge user intent in a sense.
Yes.
And how do you distinguish between, like, how do we say, user intent versus, I don't know. Let's say you do a painted door test and you're like, well, we found that X amount of users clicked on this fake feature, went to this landing page, it said it's under development or whatever. Like, how do you sort of determine between intent versus, they clicked on it versus, okay, well,
were they just curious?
Yeah, they might have just been like, oh, there's a big button here that's red. And do you know what I mean? Do you sort of have to still read between the lines there?
Definitely. Yes, absolutely. And I think that's where the quantitative qualitative piece where I said it's a loop, that's exactly another loop of the iteration. So, oh, okay, people are actually clicking on this. Therefore, let's talk to the people that are clicking on it. Instead of trying to talk to everybody, you can send an in-app message to those people, email those people, get on a call with those people. But then you've also got to think about the flip side of if they're not clicking on it, is that because they don't want the feature, or they're not clicking on it because you did a really bad job of labeling it, or
maybe the UX put it in a place that's
not good. So that's one of the things you've always got to be thinking about, is like, what could be causing my conclusion to be incorrect, and what could be causing it to seem correct when it's actually not.
Why do you call it a loop as opposed to why do you call it the quantitative qualitative loop? Like what's the sort of feedback process involved in that?
Yeah, I think the key thing is that it's like a circle. It doesn't end. I think that's a key part of it, is that it just kind of keeps going and feeds into itself. Like, you learn something qualitatively, and then you want to get sure about that, so you want to layer in a quantitative piece. But then that quantitative piece probably reveals something else that you want to explore more qualitatively in order to generate further future ideas. So I like that it reinforces this idea of it being a continuous process, continuous improvement, and not something that's like, oh, you do research, qualitative research, and then you design a quantitative split test, and then you're done, and that's it. And then you go and do that with something else. It's like kind of focusing on how you want to feed things into themselves. You want hunches to come out from your various analysis and ideas. So you want to be able to kind of intertwine it together, as opposed to what I think is a common trap where you're just kind of throwing out all different things across the board that just aren't connected to each other. Because not only do you want to have a North Star metric, like we were talking about a few minutes ago, I think you want to have a North Star vision. You want to know what you're working towards in the bigger picture, and informing your process as you move towards that. So your minimum viable experiment, how can you validate the things that help you understand if that's the right thing to be building, but also understanding whether that's even the right thing, because it's going to change your mind along the way and be able to adjust that. Because if you're just thinking about one foot in front of the other, you could easily walk off a cliff.
Actually, that's a Lee Sonic segue. You talk about, I think it's in your Medium article, your minimal viable experiment versus minimal viable product. Maybe you could discuss that with our audiences and what's the differences and those sort of things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the minimum viable experiment is something that probably is very intuitive to a CRO or a CRO that turns into a product manager, and for a product manager that comes from a different background, because very rarely does somebody in product management come straight from that. It's a hard learning curve if you go straight into it with no other work experience. It's easy to miss. So startups and lean startup and product management talk so much about the MVP, creating the minimum viable product. And that is really great advice, but making a product is a lot of work. It takes a lot of time to make a product. And so if the first thing you do in order to validate your idea is to build something, there's a lot of people that would probably be offended by me saying it, but that's probably not the right idea. You want to have more certainty than just, I think this is a good idea. And I don't think that any product manager or entrepreneur or founder worth their salt is doing that, or is really tempted to do nothing. But the minimum viable experiment is a framing to think about it in a more structured way. So rather than it just being a hunch, it's how can I design an experiment that confirms that this is the right thing to build. And so there's lots of different ways to approach that, but it's really looking at it through that lens. So a recent example of that product that we were building at my current company was looking at a recommendations tool. And in this case, we were actually building it because we'd already run the experiments to figure out that people wanted recommendations, because there's 24,000 things to choose from in our catalog of inventory. And then there's myriad ways to tweak and adjust those and configure them to get them to exactly what you want. So you can almost imagine it as like basically infinite possibilities, which is exciting, but also overwhelming. So you want some way to be able to narrow that down. And so the way that we designed our experiment to figure out what we were building and whether it was going to meet the needs of the customer was we took the same question of, in this context, as this advertiser, what inventory would you test? And we asked that to expert media buyers with a decade or more worth of TV media buying experience, and asked them to answer that question. And then we had our algorithm answer the same question. And then we measured the difference between those two in order to figure out how similar was the expert and how similar was the robot, and using that in order to measure it. So that was the experiment, rather than the much more complicated experiment, which comes afterwards, of you ship that feature out and measure, okay, if somebody uses these recommendations, how does their performance compare to somebody who didn't? There's a lot of variables in that and a lot of noise to try and hold constant. And so that's really tricky. And it's also, you kind of got to let the horse out of the gates before you can even find out whether it's a good idea. And so sort of more creative experiment design is something to look at. And where quantitative and qualitative can kind of work together can be really handy, because we didn't run an A-B test. We just asked people, well, what do you think? And then compared that to what does the machine think? So
that's really interesting. Do you ever do these sort of things concurrently though? Like does it have to be an either or thinking, or can you sort of
no really I think concurrently? I think something that I've learned in my career is that almost nothing is either or. Almost nothing is black or white. There's always a way to do both, a way to consider both, and so you want to balance between focus, but you also want to not do everything in this waterfall linear fashion where you do one thing after the other. So I think that's where prioritization comes in as key, and then looking at how much can you do at once before hitting like a point of diminishing return. So you don't want to have so much work in progress that nothing gets done, because then you don't get the benefit of it. You want to front load value delivery so that you're actually finishing something and getting that out there and in the hands of users. But also, if you get 20 people into a kitchen to make a pizza, it's not going to happen 20 times faster than if you just have one person in there. And in most cases in technology, the number is not one, but it's not all that far off it. It's usually two or three people is really the sweet spot working on a given thing, depending on the size of it, of course. So you kind of can have a few of those in a team. So if you've got a team of six or nine people, you could have two or three things on the burner at once.
You talk about also, I think you've mentioned this before. No. Sorry, I'm just going to the show notes. Prioritization and identifying your riskiest assumption. Maybe talk about that for a little bit. Yeah.
So when it comes to prioritization, impact is often a big part of decision making in any sort of prioritization, like what's really going to move the needle. And then you want to look at risk as well. How likely are we to achieve that impact? But in the product world, you also have to think about risk in terms of the chances that you're wrong. So you got to look at your assumptions and map those out, which is like a whole process. But you can also just think about, where might I be wrong? What do I think I know that I don't? And then you want to look at the consequences of being wrong. And so you want to dig into those and design experiments in order to validate those. So the idea of like, there's two types of risk. You've got things that you can know and things that you can't know. And so the things that you can't know, you want to focus on just like getting it out there and know in advance. This is, you just want to get it out there. You want to ship early, reduce the time to actually figuring it out, and then reduce the surface area as well. Maybe don't ship it to everybody. Maybe ship it as a beta and learn that way. And then the things that you can learn in advance through experimentation, you want to be able to like set up those experiments, but focus on the things that matter. So if you're building out a whole new feature for how to do retargeting on TV, for example, if you're building that out, maybe you don't want to worry about the color of the button and whether it should be on the left or the right, and building a split test around that. You want to focus more on, okay, how much can a given advertiser spend on this? And is it enough where they're going to bother? Because if they can only spend $100 a week, what use is that? But if they can spend $10,000 a week in order to generate a 5x ROAS, then that's a much more exciting possibility. And you can test that out before you build out the feature and capability. You can do it manually.
Do you have to like sort of sort out, you know, when you're looking at your, like, so the experiment's finished and you're doing some post-test analysis, do you have to like sort of distinguish between signal and noise in this area?
Yes.
I'm just sort of throwing it out here because I'm thinking like, well, you know.
How do you know for sure? And I think in a lot of these sorts of cases, it's even harder than in a CRO world where you can hold a lot of those things constant with volume. But when you're running a more qualitative test, it certainly gets harder. That's where I think the test framework really comes in, is really important, making sure that your experiment design has these things figured out up front. I think one of the most important aspects is your exit criteria. When is your test done? And not just when is it a winner, but also when is it a loser? Because one of the things that you can often do is I'll just keep it running eventually. We'll get more data and feel more confident. So making sure you set yourself up for that before the data starts coming in and you kind of negotiate yourself into whatever you have your own predilection for, whether you want the test to win or want it to fail, kind of changing your criteria to match. So yeah, that's something that you definitely want to keep in mind.
I think we also you also discussed about getting smart versus getting lucky. Maybe you can explain
Yes, getting smart versus getting lucky. So I think that's a trade-off that you really have in your experiment design. So getting lucky is where you are sort of throwing things against the wall, and then if the experiment turns out to work, if A wins or C wins, then great, you run with C and you're making money out of that. But did you learn something that you can apply in other contexts? And that's sort of the trade-off of getting smart versus getting lucky. So if you want to take a really big swing, you can change everything, redesign the whole page, and then you can compare those two layouts and see which one wins. That's a great getting lucky test. But a getting smart test would be either running it as a multivariate experiment so that you can see which individual components, or doing it incrementally where you change one piece at the time, change the above the fold, change the headline, change the layout of the page. And so that's a lever that you've got when you're designing your experiments to decide which way do you want to go. Because getting smart might sound like it's always the answer, but sometimes getting lucky also means getting a nice ROI that funds you to push a little harder in a different project in a different direction. So like all things, it's in the gray area. It's about balance. So I like to think of it that way as taking experiments in both directions. Cause sometimes you have a really strong hunch that this is the new way to go. But if you go incrementally piece by piece, it can take you a long time to get there. And you can always double back. You can take the getting lucky shot, take the big change. And then once that lands and you figure it out, if it works, then you can ratchet it back and take a more getting smart approach along the way, and maybe only do that with part of the traffic, so you're not losing out on the upside.
Do you feel like the sort of balance between that is really resource constraints as well, resource and maybe time constraints? Whereas, so if you've got like low resources, maybe there's political pressure on you to get some sort of results, you might have to go for the getting lucky approach, because you've got to get a big result. And maybe you could argue that the more scientific get smart approach is probably a bit more technically better in terms of isolating variables and what's moving the needle, but you may not have the time or budget or resource constraints to do that iterative approach. Would you say that's sort of a
absolutely you're looking at two major constraints. Your resources in terms of time and effort to be able to build out and analyze and manage the experiment. And then the other constraint of data, the amount of traffic coming in, depending on what type of test it is, but the amount of data coming in, if you've only got so much and you can learn the results to one test every week and it's going to take you 12 tests versus you take a bigger swing, do it all at once and compare A versus B, and you can learn something about that in 2 weeks. So kind of comes in. But you've got to have the minimum detectable effect in mind as well. Like you've got to have that plausibility to be able to move the needle enough to be able to even know if it's working. So that's where that trade-off comes in again, of knowing for your given experiment, is your impact proportional to the amount of data you're expecting to access? And that expecting is how much time have you got? Can you run the test for 3 months? Do you want to? Or do you need to run it for a week or two instead?
That's good advice. And I think lastly, you talked about in the show notes, we talked about the experiment log, knowledge sharing, showing your work, building a practice in other organizations. Can you maybe talk about that?
I think an experiment log serves two purposes. One is your memory is fallible. You're not going to remember all of the details. I was deeply reminded of this as we were kind of prepping for this conversation, and I was digging through some old resources, and I have a few items on a to-do list of, put together an experiment design template. And a few things like that, where I'm like, that would be a great resource to be able to talk about and showcase. But I didn't make it. I didn't end up building out the more CRO centric side of things, because I'd moved into the product side where things are a little bit different, and where it's more of these qualitative experiments. If I'd done that, I would have had it to reference and been able to share it with everybody. And so similarly, when you run an experiment and you learn things from analyzing that experiment, most of the time, a well-designed experiment, you don't just learn A was better than B or B was better than C. You're actually learning things and developing new hypotheses about why that result was that way. Mm. And you want to capture those things, not just for yourself, but for everybody else. And so one of the best ways to drive forward a CRO work stream, ways of work, building a more experiment-driven culture, or in product management, just building more experiment and data-driven product management, is to show and evangelize that work. To work out loud is one way to put it. So if you capture those resources and notes and share them around and make them expected learning, it becomes a really great tool for growing the discipline. And if you have more heads in the game, you can get more results out of that and building an appreciation for that, and start to build that culture that you need in order to have a good experimentation approach, the embracing of failure and being wrong. And so if you can show the outcomes of taking a chance at being wrong, leading to results, that really goes a long way. And it's one of the best onboarding resources you can have, in my opinion, as a CRO or a product manager. Let me go through and read the experiment logs from the last 3, 6, 12 months. The amount that you'll learn out of that, from we tried this and learned this and this was the result, is remarkable. In my years, I've only once come across a company that had anything close to that. So you'll be in good but small company if you really take a good record of those learnings.
No, that's really good advice. It is very easy to just sort of run experiments, then do the thing, then sort of move on to the next thing and not record the actual learnings. Which is like, you know, the sort of main takeaway. Look, thanks for coming on the show. How can, and explain to our audiences your journey and, you know, to maybe aspiring product managers or product managers who wanted to get an experimentation. It's really useful. How can people contact you, Bryce?
Yeah. So social-wise, LinkedIn is my biggest place. So Bryce York, you look me up on there. Otherwise, bryceyork.com. I share sort of longer form content, still on the shorter side. So articles and things there. But I would recommend both, because I share a lot of shorter content on LinkedIn. So jump on there. Shoot me a DM if you have any questions. And look forward to getting in contact with you all. I love talking about experimentation. I love talking about being data driven, and I really miss the CRO stuff sometimes, because that feeling when you run a test and it wins, it's hard to beat. A test that I ran that was a $2.04 million upside projected over the next 12 months, I still think about that feeling. So I look forward to living vicariously through you all. So hit me up.
Awesome. Thanks for being on the show. Cheers.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Romo Santiago from Experiment Nation. Every week, we share interviews with and conference sessions by our favorite conversion rate optimizers from around the world. So if you like this video, smash that like button and consider subscribing. It helps us a bunch.